Tonight on PBS News Weekend, Democracy in Crisis, we get the latest on the anti-government protests in Peru that are becoming increasingly deadly.
People are frustrated by a democracy that they don't believe is working for them, that they don't believe serves them in the way that it should.
Then after weeks of storms and flooding, California begins its more than $1 billion cleanup and recovery. And alternative energy. A remote Alaskan village shows other rural communities a path to cleaner power and a more sustainable economy. Good evening, I'm John Yang. In the streets of Lima, Peru, demonstrators are vowing to keep demanding the president's resignation despite a strong police response and a mounting death toll. At least 55 people are dead and 700 are injured. The worst political violence the country has seen in more than two decades began last month in rural regions and has now engulfed the capital city. Overnight in Lima, more violent clashes between protesters and police. Demonstrators, some waving the Peruvian flag, others pushing and shoving with police, faced a wall of riot shields. Tear gas and smoke from fires clouded the streets. Dozens of people were injured. The protesters, many from Peru's farthest reaches, had arrived in Lima this week by bus and by foot, defying the government's declaration of a state of emergency to demand the resignation of President Dina Boluarte.
We want the usurper Dina Boluarte to step down and call for new elections. Protests will continue. The south of the country is riotous at the moment.
The protest erupted across the country last month after former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and arrested. Threatened with impeachment on corruption charges, Castillo had tried to dissolve Congress and install an emergency government. Boluarte, who was vice president, became president.
We are headed to Lima to fight. We are here for the wounded, for the many deaths caused by this de facto government.
Castillo was Peru's first leader from the rural Andes region. Campaigning on the slogan, "No more poor people in a rich country," he promised to address long-standing issues of poverty and inequality. His ouster has angered his rural and indigenous supporters, underscoring their alienation from leaders in Lima.
We have come to defend our country, considering that we are under a dictatorship, a militarist government, which has stained our country with blood.
Protesters want immediate new elections to pick a new Congress, and they want a new constitution.
What we demand is the resignation of President Dina Boluarte. Also, we want the closure of Congress and new elections for 2023.
So far, President Boluarte has been defiant.
That was not a peaceful protest. The violent acts that occurred in December and January will not go unpunished. I will not get tired of inviting those who are protesting, those who have moved from the provinces toward the capital for dialogue. I will not get tired of telling them, let's work on the vision this country needs.
Yesterday, before the latest violence in Lima, I spoke with Julie Turkowitz, the Andes bureau chief for the New York Times. I asked her what she saw on a recent reporting trip to southern Peru.
In the last month, I've been to two different parts of rural Peru. The difference between the situation in Lima and the situation outside of Lima is pretty stark. The protests were happening outside of the capital. You saw a lot of roadblocks. You saw a lot of parts of the country that were really paralyzed, and a lot of anger that is happening outside of the city. And that anger is extremely present, for example, in Juliaca, in Cusco, in Ayacucho, and you really didn't see it on the streets in Lima.
What does that tell us, that this difference between the scene in Lima and the scene on the countryside, what does that tell us about what's going on?
These protests, I think, really demonstrate a rural-urban divide in Peru that has existed really for generations and generations, where a lot of people in rural parts of the country feel that the government, that the country's democracy is really only functioning for a select group of people. And so what you see in a lot of rural parts of the country is that people feel that security hasn't come to them, that economic success hasn't come to them, that opportunities for good education hasn't come to them. That divide in many ways has been exacerbated by the pandemic, which hit the country very hard, by a drought that has also hit the country very hard, by inflation, which has caused prices to rise really fast in the country. And, you know, people are frustrated by their current conditions, poverty, inequality, but more than that, people are frustrated by a democracy that they don't believe is working for them, that they don't believe serves them in the way that it should.
What is it that the protesters want?
You know, these protests began as this anger over the arrest and the removal of former President Castillo. And so at first people were asking for his restitution, and they were asking for, if that didn't happen, new elections as quickly as possible. The sort of demands have grown from there, and people are asking for a new constitution. You know, and when we were in Juliaca, we saw, you know, in rural Peru, we saw signs that said, calling for like a nueva patria, like a new homeland. And there, the frustration has reached such a level that people are sort of calling for a whole new system. What that new system is not clear.
Is this in any way say anything or tell us anything about democracies across South America, across Latin America?
What we have seen in Latin America in the last 15 to 20 years is definitely a decline in trust in individual democracies, and a decline in satisfaction with democracies. And the sort of level of dissatisfaction and the level of distrust is particularly acute in Peru.
Peru certainly is no stranger to political turmoil, is it?
It's a country that has seen 6 presidents in the last 5 years. And I think what that has really led to is, or contributed to, is a real distrust in how the country's democracy functions. There is, a study that has been really critical for us in understanding what's happening in the country that shows that just 21% of Peruvians are satisfied with their democracy. 88% believe that at least 50% of their politicians are corrupt. Kind of gives you an idea of how people feel about the government.
There have been allegations of human rights abuses in these protests.
There are many human rights groups who have accused the police of acting disproportionately against protesters, who in some cases have been violent. I mean, they've vandalized, they've burned buildings. But, you know, the police and the military, of course, have guns. And a lot of these people have died from bullet wounds.
Is there any resolution in sight?
One of the main sort of asks and demands of the protesters is that the new president resigns. And she, she was initially an ally of Pedro Castillo's, but she has really dug in her heels, and she is not giving any signs that she will sort of acquiesce to protesters' demands. And if that doesn't happen, I think this is going to keep going.
Julie Turkowitz of the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In neighboring Brazil, another democracy under pressure, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva today fired his top army commander. The move comes after far-right supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro stormed several government buildings in the country's capital earlier this month. Lula has publicly called some of the members of the armed forces complicit in that day's rioting. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky and his wife attended the funeral of Ukraine's interior minister and other high-ranking officials. The dead were victims of a helicopter crash earlier this week in the fog near a nursery on the outskirts of Kyiv. 7 other people were also killed, including a child.
And the U.S. Navy said a former SEAL who deserted his post in 2019 was killed in Ukraine this week. He's the sixth American known to have died fighting in Ukraine. No Americans are fighting in Ukraine in any official capacity. Abbott Laboratories confirms the Justice Department is investigating the baby formula production plant that was at the heart of the formula shortage last year. The Michigan facility is one of the nation's biggest sources of baby formula. It was temporarily closed in February after the FDA inspectors found potentially deadly bacteria. A new Justice Department filing in the Elizabeth Holmes case says the disgraced biotech executive had a one-way ticket to fly to Mexico just 3 weeks after her fraud conviction last year. Prosecutors are opposing Holmes' bid to be freed while appealing her 11-year sentence, saying she's a flight risk. Her attorney says the trip was for a friend's wedding and was planned before the verdict. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, California's billion-dollar cleanup and recovery for massive storms, and an Alaska community's effort to use cleaner energy and create a more sustainable economy.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
California is in rebuilding mode after weeks of storms battered the state. The storms are blamed for at least 20 deaths, and damage is estimated to exceed $1 billion. President Biden declared a major disaster, which frees up federal resources to help in the recovery.
Now that the worst of the storms has passed, the cleanup has begun.
That's, you know, scary.
Marjorie Cruz's Berkeley home was destroyed by a mudslide.
We just finished remodeling the house, so it's hard to see it all go, and we'll have to start again.
For weeks, nine so-called atmospheric rivers, long, narrow sections of the atmosphere that carry water vapor, pummeled the drought-stricken state. Torrential downpours turned neighborhoods into lakes and triggered hundreds of mudslides, resulting in widespread power outages and mass evacuations. There were sinkholes in Los Angeles County, rock slides in Fresno, blizzards in the Sierra Nevada, and there were daring rescues. In Laguna Hills, first responders airlifted a woman from a rapidly rising creek. This week, President Biden surveyed damage along the Central Coast.
If anybody doubts the climate is changing, then they must have been asleep for the last couple years. We know some of the destruction is going to take years to fully recover and rebuild, but we got to not just rebuild, we got to rebuild better.
The community of Felton, southwest of San Jose, flooded three times in 2 weeks.
It's just a lot. And then to go through the third time is just defeating.
It's always tough. You go through this emotional roller coaster. It's gonna be okay, it's not okay. But frankly, if my troubles in life is some mud on the floor and some lost gear, I consider myself blessed and lucky.
There is one silver lining. The deluge replenished some of California's depleted reservoirs.
Stephanie Tsai spoke with Brian Ferguson of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services about the recovery efforts.
Brian Ferguson, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's been a long, tough couple of weeks for California. Just describe to us the scope of the damage you're seeing and where things stand right now.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. This has really been a dynamic and challenging set of storms. 48 of our counties have proclaimed either a state of emergency or submitted damages to the state. The vast majority of our state has had impacts in some way, shape, or form, from San Diego in the south, where they were doing swift water rescues, to Humboldt near the Oregon border, where we had mudslides, and everywhere in between. And so really an unprecedented, challenging disaster that is now averting a little bit, but we have a significant amount of cleanup and recovery that is really just now commencing. The federal major disaster declaration will expedite assistance to the communities for the financial pieces, but it will be months, if not years, in some cases for these communities to repair all the damage that occurred as a result of these storms.
Just as far as the immediate damage to infrastructure, talk a little bit about where roads and other thoroughfares that may have been blocked, for example, by downed trees or downed power lines, where cleanup is with that.
Yeah, we're really lucky that we have some of the best road crews in the nation in terms of getting things back open, particularly our lifeline routes that are critical for people to either get to business or work or for shipping. Many of our coastal communities, it will be some time. There's a significant sinkhole about 27 feet around near Half Moon Bay, Big Sur and Highway 1. There are large portions that have been washed out. And then the infrastructure, the communities and the people that have been impacted are significant. And those businesses, we're trying to maximize assistance so they can rebuild and recover. But certainly not all their losses may be covered. So really the mission here is to how do we support communities, how do we support individuals and help them get back and recover and rebuild quickly.
Have there been a lot of people displaced? I've read that there were a lot of homes damaged. Whenever we think of California, we worry about housing and homelessness. And I just want to know if you know how many people may end up being homeless as a result of these storms.
Yeah, we believe that there are several thousand homes. They'll be red tagged, which means unoccupiable, either because of flooding or mudslides or debris flows. And one of the things we're constantly looking at are what are the impacts on the most vulnerable in our communities? We know that they, folks who either are older Californians, have disabilities, maybe English is their second language, those folks are disproportionately impacted by all disasters. And so a big part of the effort underway now is what services can we provide? What local nonprofits or philanthropic organizations can provide aid? So that we can help those who need help the most.
When you're looking at just the mess, that days of intense rain, mudslides, all of that has left, how do you triage that from an emergency services perspective? What is most important right now?
Well, obviously, the protection of life and property is the thing that we look at first. Unfortunately, we've experienced 21 fatalities so far. There still is a five-year-old boy who's missing that, you know, very concerned about. And, you know, the work that we do on these is really about how do we protect people? How do we keep lives? How do we keep people safe? We've also had more than 1,400 rescues that have occurred, either through planes, getting people off roofs, swift water rescue vehicles. And so really the goal of the folks at Cal OES and the state of California is to put resources into communities early before the water comes, use the best science and technology that we have to try to put firefighters, first responders, ambulances to get people out safely. And certainly this is an incident that could have been much, much worse if not for those early efforts. And, you know, we always want to learn and evolve and to get a little bit better at each disaster that we face. And unfortunately, we've had a lot of practice in California, and many of the things we've learned during wildfires or other disasters came to bear during this fight we've had the last couple of weeks.
That really brings up my next point, which is that with climate change, a lot of experts predict that California will experience a more extreme cycle between drought and wildfire and flooding. It's even been predicted that California may see a much worse storm event, a so-called megastorm, over a period of 30 days. Have these last couple of weeks been sort of a wake-up call? Do you think there will be more policies oriented toward preparation for these type of events in the future?
You know, for those of us who do this work, this is no surprise. We've been seeing the impacts of climate change firsthand with a thousand-year drought in the American West, record wildfires occurring, and all of these disasters actually compound each other. The rains that have fallen the last several weeks have been worse and been more damaging as a result of the drought and the wildfires. Our burn scars that where the fires have come through can result in mudslides. Other areas have been impacted on drought, get so hard that the water doesn't absorb in the soil and runs downstream almost like a bobsled track, picking up speed as it goes and becoming more dangerous. It is very clear that the climate change is impacting the way that we do disasters in California and the number of people at risk. And we do expect that to continue to get worse in the years to come. And that's why we're trying to up our game to keep pace. But ultimately, so much of this work is also about individual humans and households and the steps they can take to be prepared as well.
Brian Ferguson with the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In the remote village of Ambler, Alaska, temperatures can fall to 60 below in the winter, so heating the community is a big job. In September, in an effort to go a little greener, Ambler switched to a renewable energy option. Alaska Public Media's Alyssa Lachlan reports that the change means both a path toward cleaner energy and a more sustainable economy for Alaska Native communities.
Woodrow Grist is keeping the fire alive that fuels Ambler's new biomass furnace. It uses locally harvested cordwood to heat the community's water system and public facilities.
They're good. Need sucking it in already.
Now, instead of burning fuel oil, a fossil fuel, the town's main offices are largely heated by a renewable resource. Ambler Mayor Morgan Johnson expects the furnace to divert the town's limited fuel stores to private residences.
We haven't been putting fuel in the fuel tanks so far. Operators are keeping the fire going, and hopefully that can happen throughout the winter, you know, and we can save a lot of money on stove oil.
The biomass furnace system, which was installed by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, has been running since September.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
This is a welcome source of renewable energy in remote Alaska, where fuel prices are an especially high burden. Northwest Arctic Borough Energy Manager Ingemar Mathiasen says the city's situation is even more precarious now due to climate change. As spring comes earlier and snowmelt recedes, the Kobuk River, which flows through Ambler, doesn't always stay high enough for fuel barges to make it to the city safely. That can force residents to rely on planes, the most expensive form of transportation.
You're dependent on far away conflicts, like in the particular case right now, where Russia invaded Ukraine, that raises the cost for the entire world's supply of oil. And you don't want those. If you want stability, sustainability, you want to do the renewable resources at home first, as much as you can.
The biomass furnace system was installed in part because the forests surrounding Ambler are an easy resource for wood to fuel the furnace. Project manager Katya Karankevich says a steep jump in the price of heating fuel last fall made the system even more important.
It is a fantastic time for this system to come in to focus because it will be saving a lot more than originally projected.
With the new system, the city will cut its annual oil consumption by an estimated 3,500 gallons. That's $50,000 a year that will stay in Ambler.
You get the financial benefits of more jobs for biomass operators, more jobs for woodcutters, less cost for the city to have to operate and keep their doors open to the laundry and the shower services. But then secondfold, the community is more independent.
Renewable energy systems like the Ambler furnace create a circular economy in the communities they serve. In Ambler, residents are paid for the wood that they gather, chop, and deliver to fuel the stove. And the money the city saves on fuel can be reallocated to supporting its residents. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has active projects in more than 80 communities across the state. These renewable energy systems that harvest wind, water, and other sources are expected to keep money in communities and put Alaskans on a path toward a more sustainable future. Projects like these mean a lot to rural Alaskans, where the cost of living makes everything that much harder. But lifelong Ambler resident Brian Wasoski believes renewable energy systems are an opportunity to change that and so much more.
So we can be independent and we can do the things that we need to do and feel a sense of pride. You know, if you're working, if you're clean, you feel better, you know? It's just the way it is. If you can provide for your family, buy shoes for your kids, food on the table, that is a sense of pride. It always has been for me. Now you're gonna get me emotional.
While the furnace systems may not be the right choice for every rural area, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium says they're continuing to help Alaska Native communities develop renewable energy systems and move away from using fossil fuels. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Alyssa Lachlan.
Now online, our guide to how you can help victims of the California storms. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.